The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Welcome to Bro Apostles. I am Patrick Nevy, and today I am going to be presenting an interview that I did on the Catholic Entrepreneur Podcast with Silas Monner. It was a great conversation about a little bit about my book, a little bit about what Catholic business owners and Catholic professionals can do to help save their parish. It was a great conversation. You're going to enjoy it. Now let's get into the show.
All right. Welcome to the podcast, Pat. How are you doing today?
Doing well. How are you, Silas? Good to be here.
I am glad to have you, man. Catholic Pat in the building. For anybody who follows you, is that your username everywhere or just on Substack?
It's everywhere, actually. Okay. Yeah, I managed to get it. It was really nice. A guy who had it on Instagram reached out to me like a couple years ago and was like, "Hey, I have the Catholic Pat handle on Instagram. Do you just want it?" And I was like, "Dude, thank you." Typically, people will like hold you hostage for that.
Yeah,
you know, they'll be like, "Pay me $1 million," and I'll.
They definitely.
I had
do
no
that.
Money. Yeah, I had no money, so I was like, I can't. But he was a great guy, and I still follow him. But yeah, so he gave me that handle. So now I have it everywhere: TikTok, Instagram, Blue Sky, which I don't post on.
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, I hope you don't go there, man. That's a dumpster fire. But
it's crazy.
I've always tried to get the username Silas because you would think there's not that many Silases, but it's always taken. No matter how quickly I get to a brand new platform, it's always gone. I just go with my full name. But
it's crazy. You see those people that got their first name on Twitter, and it's like, how did you do that?
Exactly, especially people like, you know, Jason, right? It's like, how did he doesn't deserve that?
Yeah.
Anyways, man. Well, I'm glad to have you on. So I just kind of give a little bit of a preamble here. You run a podcast called Bro Apostles. You've been kind of popping off a lot on LinkedIn and Substack lately. And the main reason is because you're writing about how to save your parish, right? That's kind of the gist of what you're writing about, which is also the name of your recent book. If anyone's watching, you can see I've got it here. And I guess not the only, that's not the only thing that you write about. The reason I think this is very interesting is that a lot of the times we are talking about how Catholic entrepreneurs can be kind of catalysts, if you will, in their community. Mm-hmm. And I think a core part of that is the parish, right? And this is the main point of your book is how can we, I won't spoil it all, but how can we in general be the catalyst in our parish without, you know, some program or whatnot, right? So before we get into all of that and what I want to have you talk about, can you just give us a little bit about who you are and kind of what you're up to?
Yeah. So, Patrick Nevy. My bio is like, oh, a former stand-up comedian who's now a theologian, which is true. I did do stand-up comedy when I was a young man, turn of my 20s, like from about 16 until 21, I did stand-up comedy. It was real fun. Snuck into bars at 16 and did stand-up. But I kind of put that aside because I wanted a family, wanted to, you know, wake up at a normal time. So I kind of stopped doing that. I studied theology at Franciscan University, got my master's in systematic theology from there, but I've always been writing online and podcasting. We've been doing Bro Apostles. We've been doing the podcast. It was called The Crunch before, but we've been doing that for about 10 years. So I've always been producing content online, and that's kind of been my deal, right? It's like I'm, you know, learning theology, talking about it on the internet, making it easier for people to understand, talking about it with, you know, young adults, high school students. That was kind of my deal. I was a youth minister for about 4 years in Pittsburgh, and then I did what a lot of former youth ministers do when they have a kid and they realize they can't do it anymore. As I went into sales,
very common.
Because you know, if you have, yeah, I know. Like every former youth minister I know is a real estate agent. It's like that's like the big thing.
Nice,
but you know, because it translates well, right? If you try to, you got to get eighth graders to listen to you talk about Jesus. You can get, you know, you can cold call a business owner. It's not a big deal. the amount of judgment and rejection you get is minimal compared to being a youth minister. But yeah, so I switched to that. I've been in sales since I left youth ministry. So another about 3 years or so. But in the meantime, always writing online, talking about stuff. And you know, my big you know, my heart has always been for the church and for building up the church. And, you know, I thought the way that I was going to do that was for working in the institutional church, but my life has kind of taken a turn to where I'm working as a parishioner and building up my parish. My wife and I both, you know, do stuff at the parish that I was baptized in, that we got married in. And we spent a lot of our time, you know, building up the community as lay people, as lay leaders in the parish. And, you know, just that experience of after leaving ministry and still kind of doing ministry has been transformative for the way I understand the lay role in the parish, as you are not working for an institution. You're not like leading an institution, you're leading a people, you're leading a community. And that was kind of the thrust of the book. I don't think I would have written this book if I was a youth minister still. I think the only reason why I wrote this book was because I had that, you know, normal person experience of working at a job, you know, like dealing with non-Catholics every day, living in the world. And so that's what the book is for. The book is really for taking that institutional knowledge that I gained, but translating it and making it effective for people who have maybe an hour a week to focus on their church.
Yeah. No, I like this a lot. I think it's, we'll get into it in some more detail, but I think that broadly speaking, it's an ownership mentality, right? Like I picked up the book obviously to try to research before our podcast, but also I have to admit I haven't finished it, but I will say that I typically read with a highlighter, and when I have a lot of highlights, it's usually a good book, and there's quite a lot of highlights so far. So I'm very impressed with some of the like just absolute banger one-liners that you have in there, things that just really help people to understand and I think realize in another way. It's not just you kind of saying things, but it's you bringing up catechism references or encyclical references.
A decade of tweeting helps with the one-liners, I would say. That's kind of the...
That's true. I've never been good at Twitter, so I cannot say that I have any experience there. I try, but not very hard. So, but no, I think it's good. So a lot of people had a relatively, I think, negative reaction to some of the things that you posted about kind of in leading up to the book about this idea of, you know, saving your parish. And I think just to give anybody who's maybe not super familiar, not too online like we are, there's a lot of conservatives who are very like, hey, you know, if you've got a bad parish, like you should leave. You should go to another parish where there's, you know, more, you know, stronger catechism, like better teaching, better preaching, etc. And I think it's a justified like negative reaction. I understand. Cough Marcellino, but we love Marcellino, by the way. But the point is that there's a lot of people who are kind of like, hey, don't do that. So I want to have you, before we kind of get too far into the business people side of things, just explain your general take on how to save your parish. What are the core kind of things?
Yeah, so the core four, and I'm stealing that. I see a Hormozy thing in the back. I did a four-step framework, and I got made fun of because it's like, oh, another four-step plan. It's like, yes, I understand. It's a gimmicky thing to help people remember things easily.
Helping people remember things is never a gimmick, man. You gotta do what you gotta do. You gotta figure stick it out. In their brain.
Four floors, you have that internal rhyme with the OR sound. It's good. So the four floors is something that I developed when I worked at my first parish, and it was a way, because I did like a little audit of our ministries, and I was like, literally every single one of our ministries is a Bible study for old people or a dinner for old people. And I was like, let's look at our ministries and see, you know, what age groups we're targeting and what the purpose of the ministry is. And I was like, we are so heavy on these two things. And I was like, we're missing something. What else should we be doing? So I was kind of reading about parishes and like the way the church understands what a parish is. And I stumbled upon paragraph 22 of Christi Fidelis Laici, where Pope John Paul II is talking about the parish in regards to lay people. So he's talking about what the lay people should do in their parish. And he quotes Pope Paul VI from an audience that Paul VI gave to the Roman priests. And Pope Paul VI lays out what a parish is for. And he calls it an old and venerable institution, which is what makes me not want to abandon it entirely. Speaking of conservatism, we should want to conserve our institutions, I think. Hot take. But what he says the parish is supposed to do is give Catholics a stable community, give a stable community of the faithful, initiate people into the liturgical life of the church, help them grow in their faith, and then help them share their faith through explicit preaching and through good works. And so that's what the book is. It's organized around those four floors, starting on the ground floor with the human thing of community. Any institution can make a community, but what is the community for? It's for the first floor. First in priority is in giving people that personal relationship, but through the liturgy. I think that's a Catholic thing that a lot of evangelical Catholic books leave out. They kind of just rip the evangelical Protestant model and they apply it to Catholicism, but they forget to add the Eucharist and confession in there. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, Protestants already have a relationship with Jesus, so we just got to convince them about Catholicism, and it makes Catholicism seem like it's this extra thing that's tacked on to Christianity. we're done with that. First floor is initiating people into the liturgical life of the church. That's conversion. So you have community, conversion, help people grow in their faith. That's catechesis. And then help people share their faith, which is commission. And so those are the four floors. It's a four-step system. It's a cliche. It's got an alliteration acronym to help you remember it. It's a total self-help cliche, but try forgetting it. You're not going to be able to.
Yeah. Even as I was prepping the notes, I didn't have the book in front of me, but I was able to remember it and I had just read through it. So now I think it's very helpful. So in general, I guess that in my words here, you're taking the community is really just communion with other people, like friendship effectively, right? So you're encouraging people to build friendships, which then leads to a sort of community, right? And that could just be, hey, you know, once a month, we're going to meet in my living room and we're going to talk about the Bible, or we're going to have dinner together and just discuss life. Like, it doesn't even have to be necessarily explicitly Catholic, but if you're bringing Catholics together, it helps you to have those conversations. And then the conversion part, I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that. Do you have any particular perspectives on how do you bring people once you have those kind of like community building? Like, how does the conversion happen? Is it something that you try to kind of like steer in a certain way, or do you just allow God to take care of it?
I think it's a mix of both, right? It's work and pray. But the breakdown for community into conversion, the way I was introduced to it was through my youth ministry, which was like every week we got together for a youth group. And it's like, you might think that's a help people grow in their faith thing, but really that's not the point. The point of youth group on Sunday night was, let's get the kids together so they can hang out and we'll do a Jesus-y thing. But it's like, it's kind of very surface level. And the number one thing that everyone was saying was at these nights was, you got to come to the retreat. You got to come to the Steubenville conference. You got to do this. And that invitation was like, it was a lead magnet, right? There's a CTA. Again, sales taught me this. It's, you know, this is the next thing. What do I do next? And when you're in this community that's centered around faith, you're around these people that are praying together, you kind of see that they're living this life. You go, it makes the person go, well, what do I do? Like, what do I have to do to be like you guys? And the easiest thing to do is introduce them through like an intentional introduction to the liturgical life of the church. And the best way to do that is through a retreat. And that's like a very high school youth ministry way to look at it. But I've seen it work really well with things like Alpha, where Alpha, a lot of people think Alpha is like an evangelistic tool. It's really a community building tool. Alpha is you meet once a week for like 9 weeks and you talk about the big questions of life. And then at the end, they have like a day of reflection or a weekend of reflection. That's at least how we did it. And that was our community to conversion program. You can do that if you want. You don't have to. But in chapter 5 of the book, I go through, it's the first floor conversion. I go through, you know, here's what bringing someone out into the desert looks like. Here's what that retreat looks like. And it follows the St. Ignatius exercises, the four movements. And I kind of relate them to, you might be familiar with this because this is what, if you've been on like a life teen retreat, this is what they do. They section the retreat weekend off into Friday night, Saturday morning, Saturday night, Sunday morning. And it follows confession, the Bible, like Lectio Divina, adoration, and Mass. And like, those are the things you have to introduce people to help them understand how to live life as a Catholic. Go to confession, read the Bible, pray in front of the Eucharist. Go receive the Eucharist. That's how we experience liturgical life as Christians, as Catholic Christians. And so that chapter 5 of the book really goes deep into, what does that look like? How do I do it as someone who doesn't have a budget? How do I do that as someone who's a busy mom, right? Mm. How do we do this? We do a family retreat when the kids are running all over the place. It's like really tactical stuff that I've actually done and seen done well that helps people take that next step into conversion.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I also think it's sometimes challenging because we want to be persuasive. We want to be able to bring people into our understanding of the faith, but we also have to remember that everybody has had a different time and there's kind of a patience that we have to have because it's not, you know, you can't just, it's not math, right? Like 2 + 2 = 4. You have to allow people's hearts to kind of be softened by, you know, it's like, I don't know if there's a cooking analogy or something, but like eventually their hearts soften and then they're able to kind of absorb what exactly the gospel is trying to say or the catechism is trying to say, for example. Right? So I like that. Now, I personally think that this community part is really, really critical. And, you know, I have my own gripes with the Western individualism that we have because my wife is from Uganda and it's a very community-oriented country, right? They're very like, they help each other out a lot. And she's oftentimes like, man, it's like, it's just so hard to get help around here. Nobody wants to like hang out. And even ask for help in the first place. I'm kind of curious if you have any particular takes on why, first of all, do you even believe that Western individualism is kind of the root cause of this reason why we don't have as much community and we want sort of like programs to attend versus just like doing things on our own? Like, what is your take there, and how do we get around that, and how do we like break our brains as people in America, especially most of the people listening to this, to stop doing that?
So I've never had to use dating apps. I married my wife, who I met in college. She was the second woman I ever dated. And so I never really had experience of that world of online dating. But our sponsor, Sacred Spark, gave me a little taste of what that would look like because they have a matchmaker function on their app. And so I signed up to be a matchmaker. A couple of people in the Bropostles Discord let me be their matchmaker. And I went through the women in their radius and I sent them some people I thought would be good matches. And guys, there are great Catholic women out there. There are great Catholic men out there. I know, I've seen them on the dating app. All right. So now you don't have any plausible deniability when you tell me, oh, the apps don't work. Oh, there's nobody on the app. There are. I've seen them. And you can see them too by going to sacredspark.app and signing up for free today. Thank you to Sacred Spark for sponsoring this episode of Bropostles. Yeah. So the one thing you have to understand about the American mind, and we as Americans need to understand this because it's the water we swim in, is that we are very individualistic. Even when we have good community, we're hyper individualistic in the sense of, you know, freedom of association, right? That's our big thing, is freedom of association. It's everything is a bowling club. Everything is the Shriners, you know, everything is just a social club, and you have the state, and you have your social clubs, and that's the way that we look at community building. And so, for most people, most American Catholics, suburban or not, a lot of this conversation gets reduced to like suburban sprawling parishes, where it's like that's how people think about the church. Suburban or not, we have this view of our parishes as another association we belong to, with a schedule and leadership and volunteers and a program, you know. But really, what the church has done is section off the state, the geographic boundary, into different communities. And we have a real spiritual commitment, obligation to each other. Like, we owe each other something. That's another thing in America, is we often think about social relationships in terms of rights. I have a right to this, you have a right to this, and we just can't infringe upon each other. It's a very negative relationship. We very rarely talk about responsibilities to one another. And so proof of that was the main reason why my article, The Parish You Hate Might Need You, that's one big big reaction that I got, was people were like, I don't owe that parish anything. It's like, well, you do a little bit. Like, oh, I just go there for sacraments. Like, okay, well, they're giving you salvation. What do you owe in response? You at least owe something. You know, you at least owe support or like moral support or attendance. And so I think we need to ask ourselves that question as American Catholics. What do we owe each other? And it's an uncomfortable question, because we tend to think of, like, when we give something, it's like, oh, it's charity. But it's like, a lot of what we're supposed to be giving is just justice. You know, like your extra time to your church, your extra time to your people, serving the widow, serving the orphan. These are things we actually have to do. How to break it specifically? I think, like, being the first one to ask for help, it's like a counterintuitive jujitsu, how to win friends and influence people thing, that like when you ask for help, people, like when you ask for a small favor, you're familiar with that little thing from Influence Friends, right? It's like asking for a small favor. Starting with that is a great way to, like, you know, my friend Ethan was talking about this. He was like, we need a van. And so I just asked a parishioner family that has an extra van if they want to trade their old van for our newer car. And his wife was like horrified. And he was like, what? They just said, the worst they can say is no. You know, they get offended by it. That's on them, you know? Like,
yeah. Yeah, of course.
I didn't ask for their newer car, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair perspective. I like the perspective about justice. I think this is, I forget the exact wording of it. You might have to help me out with this, but there used to be promoted the seven precepts of the church. And I feel like it's now been taken down to five, right? If I remember
correctly. Yeah, five or six, I think.
It's always debated, which I'm very frustrated about that. But one of the precepts that's kind of like effectively put into the shadows is your responsibility to, I forget exactly the wording, to help out the church. And it really comes down to, we're not going to church and like paying for to receive the confession and communion and all this. Like, we're not paying for these graces, but we are receiving something. And I think that it's misunderstood that when you receive something, you have injustice again. To live out the virtue of justice is to return something for that gift that you've been given. It's not an exchange of goods in a commercial sense, but it is a out of charity that, hey, I've received all these graces. Like, I need to either spend time helping the parish, give financially to help the parish, or otherwise. And I think people also forget that justice does actually extend to the community, even if their community, mm-hmm. like your neighborhood, may not be a Catholic neighborhood, but you have injustice, you have to help out that neighborhood, that area. You have to, you know, keep your lawn looking nice, like, you know, report crime when you see it, like these types of things that people just don't have this sense of what justice means nowadays, because all they think about is just justice from like a law perspective, and they don't think about these other components of it. Do you have any commentary there?
Not too much. You kind of nailed it. But it's like, what is justice? The classical definition is rendering to each what he is due. And so I think, even from a virtue ethics perspective, we need to think about what other people are owed more so than what we are owed. And this kind of modern, oddly speaking, liberal attitude our entire country is founded on a Bill of Rights of what I am owed. Now, you could look at it the perspective of like, it's the founders discussing what the people are owed by the government. But the way we look at it is like, okay, you know, you're infringing on my freedom of speech. You're infringing upon my unreasonable searches and seizures. We all knew that kid in high school who was like talking about how he's going to sue the church or sue the school, you know, like you're treating me unfairly. I'm going to sue you. Like, that's the attitude, is like, we're going to use the state and we're going to use the law and the Bill of Rights to like bludgeon each other to death. And we very rarely think about, well, what do I owe in mm-hmm. response? And the problem is we're all thinking about it ourselves. And so we're not helping each other out. But if we all think about each other, then, you know, if I'm the only one thinking about me, then there's one person thinking about me. If everybody's thinking about everybody, then I have the Dunbar number, 150 people thinking about me, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that's interesting. And it's also fascinating that I believe the readings today were the Pharisee, you know, on the steps praying, like saying, thanks, thank goodness I'm not like that other guy.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that we're talking about this today. Obviously, this will come out another time, but I want you to talk a little bit more about the physical boundaries of the parish. And I'm also curious if you can tie this into my understanding of the church, is that it's really divided into dioceses, and the diocese as a whole should operate as a single unit. That's at least what I've learned from Christopher Pereira. But I'm curious if you want to comment on just like the importance of physical boundaries of the parish and the local aspect of it. If you can reference any catechism pieces, yeah, sure, or whatnot, would be helpful.
So the ordinary function, the ordinary life of a Christian, of a Catholic, is experienced at the level of the parish. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at it from just a personal perspective, and I don't have a citation on that, so you can just take that as like my opinion. But the goods of society are subsidiarity. The goods of society are enjoyed at the lowest level possible. Not only should goods be applied at the lowest level possible, but they're only able to be enjoyed at the lowest level possible. Even like, you know, the subsidiarity, like the national defense, right? That's a common good that we have that's supposed to be applied by the national government, for better or for worse. We only enjoy that good at the level of the family. Like, we don't as a nation enjoy national security. It's like we as families and communities enjoy national security. And so the common good is applied to the lowest level possible. Now, when you're looking at the church, it's split up into the church and the diocese. And so like the diocese is the next lowest signifier of the church. We have like these conglomerations and confederacies of dioceses in like the USCCB and, you know, metropolitan areas with like, oh, the Archdiocese of Miami is over this area. But really it's the diocese. And then you have the parish. And I think as Catholics, I think the diocese functions as a single unit in the sense of like the parishes work together. But really the Catholic life is lived in the parish. Because what is a parish? It's like, it's a neighborhood. It's a collection of neighborhoods. It is a family of families. And the other piece is like, that may have been the case decades ago when the Diocese of Constantinople or the Diocese of Corinth, like, is just the city of Corinth. But I'm in the Diocese of Orlando and I'm an hour and a half from the chancery. You know, it's I'm in a different place than the diocese that I'm in. And our parishes are kind of functioning like mini dioceses, or like the deaneries are functioning like mini dioceses. So what I will say to the geographic boundary thing is I'm less hardlined than I think I got credit for with that article. People are like, oh, so I have to go to my territorial parish. The word territorial parish didn't even show up in the article. I do think that, you know, the territorial parish means something and it should be, you should defer to it. But community is not juridically defined, right? Like my community was my parish that I attend now, even when I lived in the city, but in a different boundary, because like that's where I was baptized. That's where my grandfather is buried. That's where I got married. You know, it's like, this is my community, even though the juridical boundary is not that case. And so I think the more important thing is for us to pick and commit. Like, this does not give you a guide on how to pick a church or an argument for why you shouldn't church hop. This just assumes you aren't doing that, and that you've already the book. I mean, for those who are listening on audio, I'm holding up the book. It assumes you've already picked a church and are sticking with it, because that is how you actually gain traction. A rolling stone gathers no moss. The young Catholics have this tendency of just going wherever we want, whenever we want, because, you know, they're all equally bad. So, you know, like, that's our attitude. It's like, all these churches are equally bad, so I might as well just go when it's convenient, which I understand. I get it. I think that's the boat most people are in. Very few people are leaving a parish because of a heretical preacher. I think that's rarer than most people think. But, you know, most people are just going out of convenience or out of minute matters of taste. And in that, we're actually going to lose. We're going to lose if we don't commit, because then you're not going to be there when Ethel decides to retire and is no longer playing on Eagle's wings. When she retires, who's going to get hired? It's like, you have a say in that in 10, 20 years. And so you should set yourself up for a leadership position in the church by sticking around. People aren't going to give you a leadership. They're not going to recruit you. They're not going to be like, oh, hey, a young person who's been here once or twice a month for the last 7 years. Do you want to be on the parish council? Absolutely not. Who should we hire for this position? Not going to happen. If you want actual influence over a community, you have to show that you want, you have to show commitment to them.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I think that's a good. I try to think about, I don't want to go too off the rails here, but I've been thinking as you're saying this, all about the, in American society right now, we have this is like going into a book by Johann Kurtz called Leaving a Legacy. That's basically a merit-based society, right? Which is that if you are the best, you'll move from your small town, you'll go to a bigger city, and it basically kind of fundamentally does not reward loyalty to where you're from at all. I mean, if you're from New York City, maybe then fine. But if you're not, like many people from there, you'll have this disincentive to stick around. And this kind of just driftlessness, or this drifting through the country and constantly moving. I mean, we just moved to Nashville, right? And I chose to leave Wisconsin, where I'm from. We were back there living for a couple of years, and I want to put roots down in Nashville. So like, my intention is to stay here for a long time, but I sometimes like wonder, hey, am I doing the wrong thing by moving away from where I'm from? Like, should I just accept my lot in life where God has kind of put me as I was born? So I don't want to really get into that discussion right now, but I think it's an interesting thing for us to consider of this location piece. What do people do, like myself, who are in Nashville, where there's a whole bunch of churches in a very close vicinity? Like, you know, I don't actually know what the closest church is to me, but I go to this one that's really close and relatively close. And I like it. And it seems like a lot of people there come from further away. So I'm just kind of curious what your take is for these more metropolitan areas where there are many options to choose from. Like how do you decide about where to go?
Yeah, I do think like when we had this issue when we were in Pittsburgh, right? We had to kind of choose what parish to go to. And I think we made an error in choosing like the church that was not the one that I worked at, out of like a desire to like distance myself from from the church I worked at, like have work-life balance and all that. I think that was a mistake. I would say it's like, you have to build on existing relationships. That's the easiest way to put it. You have to build on relationships that exist already. The strongest relationships you have are with your family, with your wife and your children. The next is, you know, your close friends, people that live near you, people that have kids the same age as you, you know, that sort of thing. You have to build on relationships that already exist. And so if you're moving to a new place and you like met someone at work, I would defer to that parent. When you're let that weigh heavier in your discernment than what mass style you like the best, or who does it. I mean, we'll even say there's objectively good and bad ways to do mass, which I think is correct. Let the relationships and existing relationships weigh more heavily in your discernment than who does mass the most proper, because the relationships that you build, that your children build, are going to influence their lives more than a crappy liturgy. It just is. A lot of flack for that on the article was, oh, I'm going to bring my kid to a crappy liturgy and he's going to apostatize when he's in high school or college. Unlikely that's going to be the sole cause.
I was going to say that's a good point, because I think that people want to, this goes back to this American idea that like we outsource all of these things to like raising our kids, you know, teaching them all these things. Basically, we see them in many cases as effectively outsourced to somebody else. And that's the reason, right? Like, if you think that the church is the only reason that your kid didn't stay with the faith, then you're doing the wrong thing. You're not realizing that your life itself, was it truly one of deep faith that they took an example from you? Because most of the things that our kids learn is through seeing how we live, not hearing what we teach.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
So I think most people don't understand what pornography use actually is, where that desire comes from. I wrote an article on my Substack months ago, and it still is my number one or number two most viewed article today. Like, if you go on today, it's still one of the top trending ones on CatholicPath.com. And it was an article about how porn is not a lust problem, it's a gluttony problem. The urge to gorge yourself on nice tasting things is more similar to the desire for pornography than the desire for companionship or for sexual union. And I think that misunderstanding leads a lot of people to go about quitting pornography the wrong way. They go about it like they're trying to forget about a girl they're obsessed with at work or something. When really there's habits and desires and cravings that you've developed in yourself that are somewhat not natural to you. The desire to, you know, be with a woman you love sexually is normal, but the desire to watch two people have sex on your phone is not. And so if you have that craving, if you have that desire, you have to address it. You have to address the desire, not just the habit. You have to address it in a unique way. And two of the best people that I've ever met to talk to about that, talk about dealing with that desire, are the guys at the Freedom Group. Go to thefreedomgroup.co. If you've been struggling with pornography for years and you haven't been able to kick the habit, they have, and they've helped hundreds of men do the exact same thing. They will put you in a cohort. You will meet with them and talk with them. You'll go over the root cause of your compulsion to pornography, and they will help you overcome it. Get rid of not just the habit, but the desire for the habit in the first place. And the best part is, if you work with them for a year and you're not free of pornography, they will work with you for free until you do. So it's a year commitment, and you're basically guaranteed if you put in the work to get rid of this habit. So if you've been dealing with this for years and you want to finally kick it in 2026, go to thefreedomgroup.co and sign up for your free 30-minute consultation. Exactly. And like the I am, when we get up for the communion hymn and my poor trad music director is forced to play on Eagles Wings, which has happened in the past, I'm not worried that my son is going to be like, oh, the church is cringe when he's in college and he's going to leave. He sees me kneel for communion. He sees Mr. Zach kneel for communion. He sees his friend Gus's dad kneel for communion. Like, he sees his friend's parents praying when we get together for dinner. These are the things that he just takes for granted because he has never known a life without that. And like, that is a stronger bond. Like, that's a stronger lesson than CCD is, you know, an hour a week. So, okay, so the priest is bad at preaching. This assumes that your kid is listening to the homily. Sometimes I don't listen to the homily. You know what I mean? Like, it's that we overestimate the effect that the parish's style has on our children, and we underestimate the effect that the children that they are hanging out with, their friends, we underestimate the effect their friends have on their life. That's why people leave. They don't leave. People just leave because they gradually drifted away. That's what the Pew Research study says. 5% of people listed that as the reason why they left the Catholic Church and became unaffiliated was because they just gradually drifted away. You know, when you don't gradually drift away, if your friend is waiting for you on Sunday and doesn't notice you, he's going to be, where were you? You know, you don't gradually drift away if that happens. It's not foolproof. You know, people, kids make decisions. As I like to say, it's unfortunate they have a mind of their own, but it is a great way to that's a stronger bulwark against them leaving than just good mass, you know?
No, I think that's a really good thing. And I can comment this because I grew up going to Latin mass and I saw, you know, plenty of people who, you know, were surrounded by absolutely beautiful liturgy that, you know, they fell away from the faith and still in many cases have not come back yet. I was of the opinion that most of them would end up coming back eventually once they became kind of adults and started having kids, but it's yet to be seen in some cases. So I think that that's a good perspective. Let's shift over to this tactical stuff. So if we are, for the most people listening, we're Catholic business owners and we feel some sort of sense of responsibility that we are instruments of God's will in the world. And that's not just within our businesses, that's within our communities. So what would you kind of apply some of the tactics of your book for business owners? How would you apply that into how can we start to build this community, like build up our parish and save it?
Well, I would say that business owners have a unique advantage given that the upside of entrepreneurship is much higher than the upside of a salaried job, depending on the salaried job, of course. I think the thing that we need to understand in terms of, like, you know, the children of this world are wise in their generation, you know, make friends with dishonest wealth, understand, be wise as serpents, all those calls from the Lord. We have to be honest about, there are three ways to save your parish. One is through money. There are three ways to influence your parish. One is through money. The other is through social influence. And the third is through prayer. And we should all be doing the third one. And if you don't do the third one, you're going to suck at the other two. But social influence and money are a great way to change your parish for the better. So business owners ought to see their wealth as a necessary burden for benefiting the community. So, like, this is kind of the curse of the laity, is you have a foot in two camps. You want to have your foot in heaven firmly planted in poverty of the spirit, chastity, obedience. Like, you want to have those, that foot firmly planted. But you're also responsible for the temporal world. You're responsible for the care and cultivation of the garden of Eden, of the earth. And so that means that some people in this life are going to be cursed with wealth, power, pleasure, and fame. You know, like, that's just gonna be the reality. And so if you as a business owner are trying to grow your business, look at it as, recognize it as a burden, kiss your cross and carry it, and understand that you have a higher responsibility. I mean, go read the Purgatory and the terrace of faithless rulers, imprudent rulers. Most kings, according to Dante, spend time in purgatory because they made bad decisions. You know, it was hard for them to get to heaven because so much rested on their shoulders. If you choose to be an entrepreneur, you are choosing to be, in a sense, a ruler, a prince. And because if you look at like the economy, you look at the money that we have now and the wealth of our nation, it's, you know, greater than anything. The king of a little, you know, banana republic in Africa has no wealth compared to a solid entrepreneur in America. So I would say, like, look at your wealth as a way to benefit your community, as a necessary thing, but then be honest and be careful about that, because you can trick yourself into thinking, oh, I'm 40% so that I can have more money to help my community. It's like, well, is that true? You know, did you do that for yourself or for the community or for the health of the business or what? Be really honest, and in an abundance of counselors, there is wisdom. You know, have people you can rely on to check your wealth. Marry well so that you have a spouse that's disinterested from your material success, whose primary concern, this is why God made wives. I think this is why God made women. I'm very much motivated by Phoebe. Like, if we do this, like, we can have millions of dollars. And she's like, Patrick, I just want to, like, buy a house for our family. I just want to, like, see you in the evening. You know, it's like, it's very, women are often motivated by security. Men are often motivated by risk and by reward. And so it's important that you have that sounding board in your life. And if it's not your spouse, it's got to be another person. But yes, so that, I would say that's a long-winded answer to make sure your wealth and your business benefits your community first, because that's really what the wealth is there for. It's not just for you.
Yeah. And then some of the other things would still apply, right? So, like, if you have this entrepreneurial spirit in the first place, you should have very little excuse to say, hey, like, why can't I start getting coffee with other people at the parish and getting to know them one-on-one? So that it's not that, I mean, I find this, that we oftentimes go to church with people and we talk to them a lot on Sundays, even especially if we have social hours, and we don't really know them. Like, we just talk about the weather, we talk about politics, whatever. And how much do we know their internal struggles? How much do we know, like, the hard things they're going through? In some cases, people are blessed with a group chat where they can say, hey, any prayers for this or whatnot. But in many cases, you know, there's a lot of things that are just not surfaced. So, what do you find as some of the most impactful things to really begin this sort of, this, this momentum of getting the church to start to view itself as a community, because I'm just trying to like visualize it. Like if you've got a church that maybe has like a lot of stagnation in general, like how do you get it to from one person saying, hey, I'm going to start meeting with people. I'm going to make this monthly thing happen. I don't need any, you know, permission to do it. I'm just going to start doing these things. How does that then translate into kind of taking over the whole parish? And what would you expect the timing to look like in that? Maybe if you have any examples that you can share or the things to ensure that people do as they begin on this journey.
Well, it's a lot like entrepreneurship, right? How do you build momentum in a business is, you know, you do everything and then you start teaching other people how to do it. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs come in, like the last person most of these guys hire is a sales guy. Why? Because no one can sell the business better than you. And so the hardest thing to do is to teach someone else how to sell the business. And so when you take that into the parish, like we're starting this Family Pods thing, right? This is my wife's kind of brainchild. She kind of took it over from someone who had an inkling of the idea. Now she's really running with it. And she's like, it's so simple. It's just family dinner and prayer. Like it sounds so simple, but a lot of entrepreneurial ideas sound simple when you know, it's like, oh, why Facebook? Why didn't I think of that? You know, stuff like that. Like after a while, it becomes so obvious that people are like, why didn't I think about that? The biggest challenge has been being explicit and saying, this is what we're doing. We want you to do it too. Like you're going to have your pod of families you meet with, and then you're each going to go start another one. Like when you're ready, you're going to go start another one, and it's going to multiply like that. And you have to make the next step, right? It's like when you're an entrepreneur, you hire a sales guy, and then you know you have a bunch of sales guys, then you got to hire a sales manager to train the sales guys. You start building a ministry that builds itself and runs without much input, without much. You can just manage, you can just watch over, and it moves. And you're just in charge of the culture check. That's what my parish has done really well with our youth ministry. My parish has been it was established in 1959. It's been around for about 60 years now. A little over 60 years, and we have had 6 youth ministers.
It's a pretty good number.
Which is ridiculous. The average tenure of a youth minister is a year, like mm-hmm. not even, a year and a half maybe. And so we've had 6, and so the average tenure of our youth ministers are 10. And so we've built a crazy youth ministry that has continued for 60 years being super strong. It's gone through ebbs and flows, a lot like building, like, you know, these college football teams build dynasties. It's like, how do you have the Florida Gators win all the time for a decade, right? It's because you've built a culture of, you know, this is what we do. This is how we teach the next generation. This is how we, and so how you start that momentum is you do it yourself, you model it for other people, you then do it with other people, and then you watch them do it, and then you let them do it themselves. That's kind of the 4 steps to like training a ministry leader to go out. You model it, you have them do it with you, then you do it with them, and then they do it by themselves. And so that's how you build that momentum. And it takes years. Like years, mm-hmm. a decade or more.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate that. I think let's talk about that timing a little bit, because we're very short-sighted usually, and we like things to go fast, especially as entrepreneurs, we're pretty impatient. What is your perspective on I think you've said some, I forget the exact wording you've used, but basically we need to start thinking much longer term as, mm-hmm. as Catholics.
Yeah. The Catholic Church thinks in centuries. Most of our parishes aren't that old yet, so I'm fine with thinking in decades. But you know, the Cologne Cathedral is the analogy that I use in the book. The Cologne Cathedral was the tallest building in the world when it was finished. It took like 600 years or something to actually finish. It stalled for like 300 years in the middle. Right at the Protestant Reformation, it stalled and it kind of sat there unfinished until people in the 1800s rediscovered the plans and rebuilt it. And I think that's what we're dealing with now is, you know, I don't know what life was like before the council or before all the sexual revolution or whatever happened in the 60s, you want to blame it on. I don't know what the church is like looking like, but we were building. We were building American Catholicism. You know, things were starting to look up for us. We weren't getting bricks thrown through our church anymore, so we could actually start doing something in America. And something stalled. And we can point fingers and we can write articles and we can do podcasts about the modernists, or we can just find the plans and pick it up where they left off and start again. And that's like, we have to have a longer term vision. So I was talking to a woman, I tell this story in the book too. I was talking to a woman a couple of months ago. So I threw this story right in it. I threw the story right in the book before it went to print. But I was talking to a woman a couple of months ago and she was at my parish. She was like, I knew your grandfather. And I was like, oh, that's cool. She was like, he changed my life. I had this conversation with him. I forget what he said, but he was the reason why I came to church and why I went to the retreat. And now she's involved in running the retreat. And now she's doing something for our parish that she's affecting other people's lives. And those people are affecting other people's lives. and they're all building the parish up that my son is going to inherit. And that's all because my grandfather had a conversation with this random woman, and my son and my grandfather never met. Like, he died right as my son was, we found out we were pregnant with my son. And so he never met my grandfather, but he goes to the parish where he worked, and not even as an employee, just a volunteer. And so we can be the giants that the future generation stands on the shoulders of. Like, that, we can do that. We can start planting seeds now, that we can start planting a tree now that our children will sit under the shade of. Like, that's what we have to think of. And I think that's why families in particular have a unique call to build up the parish, because you have the foresight that maybe single people don't, which is, you know, I can see that I'm doing things now that are going to be for my children and grandchildren. And so as your kids get older, and as you kind of realize, like, oh, my kids are going to be here after I'm gone, God willing, what can I do now at my church to set them and their children up for success, and my great-grandchildren, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way to help have that longer term vision, is like, look at your kids and be like, what church do I want them to have? Do I want them to go to hop churches forever so they never have a spiritual home? No, I don't. So I need them to sit somewhere and have community. So I have some exciting personal news. Many of you know I came out with my first book, Save Your Parish, right here on my desk in February. And one of my personal benchmarks was to hit was the median traditionally published author will sell 500 copies or so of their book in their first year. And over this past week, I hit that goal. I sold officially 500 hard copies, not just Kindle, 500 hard copies of Save Your Parish. And a lot of those sales were from people who were buying the book in bulk to bring to their parish council, their parish staff, or other parish meetings to give out at their church. And so if you do that, you actually get a bulk discount. So the book on Amazon is $17, but if you buy it in bulk, it's $12 a piece if you buy at least 10. And if you want to do that yourself, if you've been thinking about getting the book for your parish, but you don't want to spend 17 bucks a person, you can go to saveyourparish.com/bulk, and you can get a copy for everybody on your team. It's saveyourparish.com/bulk. Thank you for everyone who's already bought a copy of the book. If you had no idea that I had a book, you should go to saveyourparish.com. But if you want to buy more, go to saveyourparish.com/bulk. Thank you to me for sponsoring this episode of my podcast, Bro Apostles.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I think it can be hard. I mean, even though I'm somebody who, you know, I think about, I've only recently started to really learn about my family history, and it's been really helpful to understand. And then it kind of puts it in context, what I want to do for the future, and it makes it easier to stick with. But I think that a lot of times we get so distracted by the world right now that we can't even remember those things, right? So I appreciate that perspective. I would encourage other people to, especially during Lent, this should come out still during Lent, consider finding ways to get some silence in your life, because you can't understand these things if you don't have any silence, right? And this is something that the devil has been very good at, is creating zero silence in our lives. I would like to, a couple last things here. I would like to understand your perspective on, as you embark on this, especially because it's more than just tactics. It's effectively like a frame of mind of how you approach parish life and just living life in general. How do you think about choosing, like, some people would say, oh, this is very devious, intentionally choosing certain families to spend time with, trying to get to know certain people so that you build a sort of community that's very intentionally almost handpicked rather than just kind of like roll of the dice situation. And I ask this because there's probably plenty of people at the parish who really have nothing, no interest in being part of this idea, and they want nothing to do with it. So how do you personally think about that? You mentioned, you know, finding a good wife that's going to kind of keep you grounded, like all these different things. Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, so I think you can kind of like invite people over, see who you gel with. I think more important than like unity of personality is unity of mission. I think we overemphasize the importance of getting along with someone personally, and we underestimate the power of being, you know, equally yoked with someone. We both have the same ideas. You know, it's funny, people, that one beautiful thing that I noticed in youth ministry was you had kids from all cliques, like all subgenre of high school students and I saw this in my own youth ministry when I was a kid up through the two that I ran, is that you have people that you think would never interact becoming best friends. Like quiet, artsy, mousy girl and captain of cheerleading team. You know, that's like, if you watch a high school movie, those two people don't talk, but like they're united in Christ, they're one in mission. And in a more stark way, you see that in the apostles. You have the tax collector and the zealot, you know, like those two groups, would oil and water would never mix in the ancient world, because the zealots hated the tax collectors for being collaborators. But you see that in Christ, all are one. And so finding people that are one in mission with you is very important. And the way you do that is by having conversations. You can have people over, you don't need to become their best friend for life. You know, and then I would say, like, you know, strategically talk, it's, again, kids make it super easy. A bunch of friends that I have are only friends of mine because their kid was playing with my kid and I just had a conversation with the dad. You know, that's how
it goes.
Most of my friends were actually picked by people, women my wife got along with. So like my it's like the kids and the wives are friends. And so I guess we're friends. One friend of mine, Michael, we are two boys of the same age and they became best buds and our wives became best friends. And I told Michael, I was like, if we have kids at the same time, if we have our second kid at the same time, we're going to be stuck for life. And we did have, we both had daughters at the same time and now they're little buddies. So that's kind of as for guys, but like just have people over, just do a bunch of one-to-ones with guys after mass, like just have a bunch of conversations. You'll find the people that bring it up. Be like, what do you think about our parish? What do you think we should be doing differently? What do you think we can do? Just have these conversations. The more conversations about this you have, the more information you'll get and the more you'll find your people and the more good you can do.
Yeah, I like that. It is really simple. It honestly is like anybody is capable of inviting somebody to go hang out for coffee, right? Like having that opportunity where you have much more than, you know, I do this thing where I meet a lot of Catholic entrepreneurs. I have like a 15, 20 minute call with them and it's very introductory, very basic stuff, right? But then it's like, okay, how do we go to the deeper level whenever we're called to, like, how do we become, have a deeper relationship with each other? And it's the same thing too. It's like I said before, you could have coffee chats with people at church in the basement many, many like months or years, right? And still not really know the person, but getting that time to really have an hour or so one-on-one is very helpful because then you have a deeper connection than just like, hey, I see you at church every Sunday. It's a very, very different type of relationship. So I think this is good. We've covered pretty much all the major things I wanted to get over. I am curious if you're willing to share, like, what does the future look like for you as you have published this book? I'm not sure how it's going. I think, again, I really hope a lot of people read this because it's not like some like, oh, this is a silver bullet to solve your parish's issues. You have a really good perspective on it. I hope people read it. But what does the future look like for you? What are you excited for?
So one thing I'm excited for, you know, this book was trying to get people the process in front of people so it's as simple as possible. And then the next step, I was having a conversation with a friend. I was like, the next step is just giving people tools that they can use to make it really easy. So I've been developing something I'm calling Ministry OS. It's what I wish I had when I was a youth minister. It's something that tracks people, relationships. So it's kind of like a CRM. It's got events, tracks budget, it tracks content for events. And it's all right now, it's just a Notion board. If you want it, you can go to saveyourparish.com/ministryOS and you can get it. Right now there's a Notion board, but I'm trying to work on building it into an actual like mobile app or something that you can just do on your phone. You don't have to learn Notion to use it. But so that's what I'm working on right now. I think that'll be a good addition to the book. And then talking to a couple of parishes about just coming out and giving a workshop for their staff. Because I really think that one great way to achieve what I'm looking to achieve, which is making the parish a people, not an institution, is breaking the mindset of the institutional parish staff thinking they have to do everything. There are things that I set in motion when I was at my first parish that are only coming to fruition now. And it's only coming to fruition now because I helped the volunteers, the parishioners, set up success. So we started an evangelization team. And after the book came out, Pam, the one woman who runs it, texted me, "We're still doing it 6 years later, and we've brought 300 families that left the church back into the church." I'm like, "That's great. I didn't do any of that. I just gave her the tools she needed to run." And so I'm in the talks with a couple of parishes to do workshops for their staff and kind of help them break this mindset and then do a parish mission for their church afterward and do like calls afterwards. So trying to give the parish like a whole consultative package that actually consults rather than gives them a binder. Like, yeah. Here, write a mission statement, you know, here are the programs you need to run. Like, no, that's stupid. It's more of like a mindset and, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
Those are the two things I'm working on.
That's awesome, man. I'm really excited for what this work can do. I think, again, with these things, it's very easy to be like, oh, that's a great idea. Read the book and then just think about it and say, yeah, it'd be great. But in reality, the thing I like so much about this is this principle of subsidiarity, where it's like, you're not saying there's one way to do things. Every parish is going to have its unique items of how their culture is and how they work. And you as a parishioner there will know those things. Like, you'll know what to focus on. I do want to make an offer for anybody who's listening to this. If you guys sign up for Catholic Founders Guild, I will send you a copy of the book as well as part of that. I am very convicted that this is something that can really transform a lot of America. So I encourage Catholic business owners everywhere to be part of it. So thanks so much for coming on, Pat. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, of course, man. It was great talking to you.